I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. Peter Johnson joins me now. He and John Walsh have written To the Lighthouse, an Explorer's Guide to the Island Lighthouses of Southwestern BC. The photography is by Richard Paddle, and it's a gorgeous guidebook to these historic lighthouses that are throughout this coast. The stories of the 25 lighthouses in this book are quite fascinating. You get a sense, of course, of the importance of lighthouses in our geography and identity as a coastal province, but also history and sovereignty, the elements, as well as wonderful stories of the unique people who manned these lighthouses over the last century or so. I'll ask Mr. Johnson about the efforts to preserve these lighthouses in light of all the de-staffing that's been happening. In fact, proceeds from the book will be donated to the Sheringham Point Lighthouse Preservation Society on Vancouver Island. And I'll get Peter to tell us about that particular lighthouse and why it's close to the authors of this book. Peter Johnson is an award-winning historian and author who's authored several books, including Quarantine, Life and Death at William Head Station, 1872 to 1959, which was a finalist for the BC Historical Federation's Lieutenant Governor's Medal for Historical Writing. He joins me from Vancouver today. The book is published by Heritage House. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, Peter Johnson. Mr. Johnson, good morning.
Good morning. Nice to be here.
Thanks for joining us. Now, the purpose and importance of lighthouses, because, I mean, over the last 15, 20 years or more, they've sort of diminished from, say, the public's attention. Historically, I mean, what was the purpose of a lighthouse?
Well, what initially, when they started de-staffing, and you're absolutely right, in the late 80s and early 90s, they were sort of, for the longest time, left to oblivion, and they're wonderful obelisks to our culture, you know. And I think it was the people at Sheringham Point Lighthouse Society that got together and said, look, you know what, we need to start lobbying and create a climate such that these things can be saved. So way back in, I guess, 2003, Terry Alcock and the late Jim Ryan and other members of the board of directors started working on it. And then in 06, I guess, John Walls, who was the director of the Sheringham Point Lighthouse Society, said, look, we've got to raise some serious money here, even if to just to paint the outside of the structure, never mind rebuilding the whole site. Mm-hmm. Of the outhouses, the lighthouses, the lighthouse and the Foghorn building and the other buildings that were on the site, even though the tower is very much extant. And John Walters' idea was to do a coffee table book of photographs of lighthouses on the coast. And they started looking for a writer to put it together, and several started and never finished, and then it sort of died. And along the way, John read Quarantine, and he asked my publisher if he would call me, which he did, and we talked briefly. And I had settled not to do it. I thought, I'm just starting a biography, and I'm not sure I want to do the research required for the lighthouses around the coast. So I went over to Pelham in Sydney, and we sat down and had, and this is the truth, a race rocket beer and a chat in Sydney. And I was all set to say, look, John, as project manager, find someone else. I can't do the writing. And by the time the meeting was over, I'd agreed to do it. We were both highly enthused. But we made a change. We said, look, let's make this a cheap $20 guidebook, an explorer's guidebook, so people can get out there and go and see them with maps. Because you own a place by embracing it. You know, I'm an immigrant kid from Liverpool, and you take on your new country by tramping through it and going to it. And I thought, it's one thing for it to remain an abstraction, but if we tell people how to get to Cape Beale or to Carmana or to Chrome Island or Estevan and tell them the stories attached, then people will start to look at it and connect it not to just an abstraction, but as an exercise that they can do in the summer, a non-tourist exercise.
Yeah.
So it gelled as a non-tourist guidebook and produced itself very quickly after I decided, all right, I'll write it for you.
Yeah.
With great back and forth. John's got knows everybody. He's a book agent himself. And so he knew the people that I should talk to. And then I researched The Colonist and other previous books. And I've got to mention Donald Graham's two fine books that were written in the mid-'80s. Keepers of the Light and Lights of the Inside Passage. They're great books. And a couple of years later, Tannock and Kreska wrote a book called Guiding Lights with contemporary interviews and wonderful photographs. So there were a few older lighthouse books around,
yeah.
But nothing that was cheap enough to stick in somebody's pack sack and use on a trudge, say, to Lennon Island or, say, to Cape Scott, which would be some remarkable thing, or kayak across the Fiddle Reef.
So if I had the book, and I've written in it, scribbled, it's weather-beaten because I've tried to go to some of these places. That would matter to you, would it?
That's the way it should be.
Yeah.
A book should be dog-eared, full of jam stains and beer stains and comments in the margin. And the whole purpose was to be anti-tourist, in a way. Look, you can get to this yourself on a bicycle. Please use a bicycle or a kayak for some of the harder ones. So we made it such that 11... of the 25 are available easily in a day trip.
Mm-hmm.
Some in an afternoon. Some you can get to on a transit bus, or there's a parking lot beside. Some require a short half a mile paddle in a kayak, or a BC ferry across to Main Island or Gabriola Island.
So we're in Vancouver. What's the closest one to where we are?
Where we are in Vancouver?
Yeah.
Oh, it's not in the book because we did the island ones, but obviously Point Atkinson.
Yeah.
And you can drive right to the parking lot. And similarly, you know, Fishguard in Victoria, and Active Pass on Main Island, Cape Mudge on Malcolm Island. Amphitrite is on the mainland near Euclid. So most of them, 11 of them are able to be gotten at either a day's drive or a bicycle.
And you guys have been to all 25 that are in the book?
Collectively, probably not. We've been to just about all of them. Richard Paddle, the photographer, certainly has.
Yeah.
I've been to most. I haven't been to Cape Scott, and I haven't been to Quatsino, which is 40 miles down a long channel at the north end of the island. That's a 50-mile slog plus a two-day kayaking trip. But of the rest, I've been to most of the rest. And made it a point to see them, and the slug going was great fun. We just got back from Brace Rocks, and that was an incredible trip, given it's an ecological reserve. So they sort of are symbolic in the sense that they sort of preserve the memory. They're not just obelisks of light, you know.
Yeah.
They preserve memory.
So of the 25 that are in this book, how many are manned today?
Not many. Yeah. Maybe 5, 6.
I see. And they'd be under the auspices of the federal government, is that right?
The Coast Guard Service,
yeah.
Yeah, but you know, they're being unmanned regularly, as are the Coast Guard stations, and that's a real retrograde move for the nickels and dimes they're saving.
Yeah.
They are losing out on some wonderful chance to sort of pinpoint some fine history and do some real worth. Are you kidding? It's not the GPS system that saved the Queen of the North when it ran up on an island, I'll tell you, in 2006. And yet the lighthouses have saved so many people from oblivion on the graveyard of the Pacific. And the keepers themselves were just heroic, self-sacrificing workers. So they're real symbols of both permanence and the passage of time. And represent, you know, standing on a beautiful headland, the idea that we should go forth and explore, but they're also a call home.
Yeah.
You know, a return to home and hearth. So they stand for that simple notion that we should care for each other. And that's not readily visible in a handheld GPS that we care.
Exactly,
you
know? Yeah.
So they're shooting themselves in the foot, I think. In other countries, it wouldn't happen.
Yeah.
For example, at Cape Martha's Vineyard,
mm-hmm.
United States, the government just lifted one 40 feet and pulled it back 200 feet for the tune of $700. And most of the lighthouses in Europe are funded by federal government. It's only this place that seems to be anti-history, and it drives me nuts.
Yeah. In terms of how they're lit and the lights themselves and what they're made of, because in the book you talk about how a lot of these people over the years have gotten rather sick because of the mercury and the sort.
Right.
What do they use now as opposed to, say, what they used 120 years ago, say?
Well, they're all electric. They're all
powerful, now, yeah.
Powerful electric today. today, but you know, in the 80s and below that, all through the 40s and stuff, they were either acetylene-driven, and before that, of course, they were whale oil and on wicks. But the whole structure that made them incredibly heavy, which made the lighthouses themselves very strong, was that these lights had to revolve, or the baffles had to revolve. And so on clockwork revolving apparatus, they were lubricated with liquid mercury. And as you know, liquid mercury causes Minamatis disease. But the lighthouse service here, the Department of Marine and Fisheries, didn't keep records, nor did they let the lightkeepers off their lights for doctor's visits. And the number of people who died of leukemia due to Minamatis disease is just not traced, and so the federal government's not responsible. Plus, the lightkeepers, every 2 years, had to paint some of these 200-foot towers with lead paint. So who knows, you know, what kind of lurking disease. They were miners, only they were above the ground for all intents and purposes.
Yeah, that's the other thing about this book, because other than having great writing in it and, of course, marvelous photography, are these stories of the people who, over the last century or so, have manned these places.
Yeah.
What sort of research was involved in getting to know the people?
I visited several lightkeepers' daughters and sons up and down the island, read a lot of archival stuff in the Daily Colonist, read all the lighthouse books that I could manage, and did a fair amount of internet work to pull out some striking stories. Do you want to hear a couple?
Yeah, because some of them, you know, you'd think that running a lighthouse is something for solitary people, but some of these people also had their families with them, right?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. There's some marvelous stories. I'm curious to know which ones you'll share with us.
Sure. I like the one with family at, I guess it was Cape Deal, and Emmanuel Cox went with his family and three children at the turn of the century, and part of the cog mechanism that revolved the light broke down, so he got permission to leave his station, leaving his wife in charge, to go to Victoria to have the cog replaced, and while he was away, a barkentine, a huge ship, 250 feet was seen offshore, drifting inevitably towards the rocks, because the northeast set of the current, even in calm weather, would inevitably drive the ship on the rocks. And so Patsy got on the telegraph and said, look, there's a ship in grave danger, and unless a tug is sent from Victoria, this ship's going to founder, and all the people on board are going to die. And the tug company said, we won't send a tug unless you give us a $500 surety that when we arrive, you know, we've got some payment, even if the damn thing is sunk.
Uh-huh.
And she said, I'll guarantee payment out of my own personal bank account. And the tug left Victoria and sent a line aboard the Coloma and pulled it off yards from the rocks, saved everybody on board. Little Patty was 9 years old.
Huh.
So the self-reliance, you know, in watching her dad and learning Morse code and acting that way with confidence to convince the tug company tells you something about the independent, self-reliant life that these stations passed on to their kids, you know.
Yeah.
I think it was Howard Piercy at Chrome Island blew his thumb off and in the 1930s, I think, because he found a blasting cap left over from when the Chrome Island Lighthouse was built at the bottom of Denman Island. And it was a given that the lightkeepers must not leave the light under any circumstance. And here's a kid got his hands mangled and a thumb blown off. So Father Tom wrapped the kid's hand and his thumb and put him in a rowboat, rowed him 300 yards across to Denman Island, said, look, you go find the doctor. I've got to go back to the land. And he did. The kid wandered through the bush and found the damn doctor, and the doctor took one look at him and said, we'll fix you up all right. And the old man just got a few gray hairs.
Yeah. And then there's some people who, unfortunately, drank themselves half blind as well, right?
Well, the aloneness on some of those places was pathological. And in many ways, exacerbated, I think, and I've got to lay it out here, by the indifference of the Federal Lighthouse Service.
Mm.
I think they were paid the lowest, Well, they are, according to some documents. They're the lowest of any civil servants in Canada. For example, in 1971, the average BC light keeper got $6,000 a year.
A year?
Yeah.
Wow.
In 1871, a keeper made $125 a year.
Huh.
You know? And so, and out of that, they were forced to pay for their assistant keeper, if another keeper was required, their fuel, their light, and all their food, and their mail. So many quit in disgust, many just drank. I mean, if you were lucky enough to take a family, guess what? The children need educating and socializing. And the lighthouse service, the Department of Fisheries and Marine, were indifferent to the children's education until Evelyn Bruton, who was at Crome, organized all the other mothers up and down the coast and said, look, we want payment. If we're going to teach correspondence courses to our kids, we want some kind of a stipend for doing this. And after a great hue and cry, the federal government promised them $30 a month if they had a group of four, which would knock out, you know, 75% of them.
Yeah.
So some had to send their kids into the closest town and have them board, as you would send a kid away to boarding school. Not a way to bring up a child.
No.
What's and great stories.
Yeah. Well, what's the name of the chap who is considered the Arthur Erickson of lighthouse designers?
Oh, Colonel William Anderson.
Yeah. And it's so of the 25, how many of those do you think he designed?
I think he probably designed 10 or 12, with all of them being related. I mean, he was responsible for some fabulous designs. Estevan Point is a really good case in point. This design's exactly the same as it in Lake Superior and in Newfoundland. And in a way, Sheringham is an outgrowth of that because of its buttresses. He had these wonderful flying buttresses, which would enable the thing to sway but not fall down to handle the compression strength. And his work for the Ontario militia during the Fenian raids in 1862 made him realize that, you know what, we need strong guardians around this coast. So he rose through the ranks and became the chief designer, and I think he's created 330 lighthouses around the world that have his stamp. Very fine, tapering, long lights with a protruding top on it, sort of an apple core design, with buttresses attached to prevent them coming down. There was a huge earthquake at Estevan in the 1930s, and the damn thing barely moved.
Huh.
So a fine designer. And I mean, the standards were pretty critical. Because remember, these things are upward of 200 feet high,
yeah,
with nothing but a stone attached inside ladder and a little shed below.
Yeah.
Interesting yeah. designer.
Yeah.
They learned from the Scots how to do it properly. It was the Scots that were building them on the North Sea, interlocking granite stones and building a shape such that it would fend off the hurricane force winds around the south coast of Ireland. So they learned from a lot of Scottish designers.
Yeah, and they've lasted long, haven't they? I mean,
they sure have.
Yeah.
But when you consider, you know, the Eddystone light off the south of England and the Fastnet light, they've all been blown down.
Yeah.
And ours haven't been blown down. We nearly lost a couple to fire, and some were just replaced because they were wood. I mean, here we built them out of wood until reinforced concrete said, no, we've got to keep this light. And it was business that forced the government finally to say, look, we need some big lights at Cape Beale and at Carmanah. That gate to Wanda Fuca has got to be lit by two lights, one on the American side, one on the Canadian side. So it was the coal industry and the growth of Vancouver and the growth up in Nootka Sound and Barclay Sound that pushed the government to design some proper lights at the turn of the century.
You can see where development happened.
Yes, you can.
Yeah.
Yes, you can. And where accidents happened prior and the savings of lives since, you know, all up the coast through, I guess it was the Caribou Gold Rush and then the Alaska Gold Rush that created all the ones up the inside passage from Pulteney to Egg Island. And they're just wonderful structures.
Well, was it the lighthouse at Sheringham Point where you tell the story of the wedding that took place there?
Yeah. Yeah. Jim Bruton. You're not supposed to do that. And the 39 pages of instructions that grew out of absolutely nothing in the I guess, 60s, were really quite funny.
Yeah.
Jim Bruton painted the whole inside of the tower matrimonial blue, and the standard color is gray for the inside, and he said, bugger that. My daughter's getting married, Sharon. I spoke to her at length, and I think they got the whole wedding party up into the top of the tower. But to get through to the gallery, the little hand-railed ridge around the top required going through almost a submarine door, because a keeper every day would have to get out there and lift off the fish that were blown up during the gales, or the birds or what have you that hit the light. And so they all crawled through the submarine exit sort of door onto the gallery and had their picture immorally taken, and he projected the whole ceremony down to the people on the ground with a handheld VHF system.
Yeah.
I don't know if he got hell or not. I don't think he cared, actually, at that point. He was so put off. Because on the site was a bomb shelter.
Uh-huh.
And in the Cold War, the rule was you and the assistant keeper go in the bomb shelter and close it behind you, and your family is not allowed. And I just said, bugger that. That's the stupidest thing I've ever heard of. And the Jim Bruton turned the bomb shelter into a mushroom farm.
Yeah.
And so then decided that's stupid and just filled it in and knocked it down.
Yeah, so how many managed to get to the top of the lighthouse, and then there were the others at the bottom, you said, right?
Yes, well, they couldn't get them all up there. I think they had 17 around the top, which is pretty interesting.
Yeah.
And then the rest of the wedding party down below watching and clapping and doing what you do at a wedding, you know?
Yeah. So that's a special place for all of you guys, right?
It surely is, and it's doable in a half a day drive or a bicycle trip from Victoria. The view from the headland is wonderful. And that's the other thing too, you know, the lighthouse is almost stand as symbolic for the sort of God in nature, sublime idea of the sublime in the 19th century, where the landscape was revered.
Mm-hmm.
And when they knock them down, it's going to be few and far between that take heed, that landscape has very powerful emotional qualities. So a bean-counting metaphor for this demanning and destaffing and removal, they're thinking of removing Sisters Island light because of vandalism. They're doing far more than that, than maybe it's cheaper to knock them down, but it doesn't say a heck of a lot about their sense of history or culture.
Yeah, that's a sense that I got reading the book. It is just how it defines this place, how it defines British Columbia.
It really does. They are obelisks to our collective past, you know,
and
signal points to a future that says we must care. It's like a cross on top of a hospital or a church spire, but both of those are connected to different kinds of mercy, you know.
Yeah.
The lighthouses were even more exclusive, and they protected everyone. And the people inside them were deemed, you know, heroes and self-sacrificing people. They're very much appreciated up this coast. At Cape Mudge, the keepers come out and talk to people in the summer. I mean, many of them, thank God for these preservation groups that have got together, have hired university students in the summer to walk people around the sites and recovered archival photographs. Well, we need to do this. This place has no history.
Yeah.
Or too little history that's cared for.
Yeah. I mean, if you didn't write this book, we'd lose these stories.
Well, there are better books and thicker books. Winters Reads, but this one's a cheapie, so people can get it and help the Preservation Society. And go tramping and find a light. I mean, some of them, like getting to Heshkriat, and I flew to Heshkriat in a helicopter. I was lucky. But getting to Heshkriat requires getting to the outer coast of Nootka Sound, walking through the Heshkriat Park, and there aren't any trails along the beach, and it's bear-infested. This is a wilderness trek. And think of doing that and having a goal of this incredible flying bus light at the end of the peninsula. I mean, that's something to freeze your memory and make a summer.
Exactly.
Take your 5 or 6 days. Or the West Coast Trail.
Yeah.
You cannot do the West Coast Trail without stopping at Cape Beale or Pechina or Carmana or Sheringham. I mean, there are vanguards on that trail. And the keepers at Pechina still greet hikers in distress and do their bit for people getting into the country, which I think one needs to do to develop a beyond the political sense of this place.
Exactly. You, John, and Richard have done such a service with this book. It's been such a pleasure talking to you today about it, Peter.
Well, I'm pleased that you called. Thank you very kindly.
Yeah.
And on behalf of my two buddies, John and Richard, that's just great.
Yeah, you've made me want to go see a lighthouse now.
Well, please do. They're there. You can see them from the ferries, in fact.
Exactly, yeah.
Take care.
Yeah, the same to you. Peter Johnson and John Walls wrote To the Lighthouse, an Explorer's Guide to the Island Lighthouses of Southwestern BC. The photography is by Richard Paddle. It's published by Heritage House. Do pick it up. It's a beautiful book, and the stories in it are just timeless, wonderful stories. You'll have a lot of fun reading it. And if you use it to go see these lighthouses, it's a great way to start the journey. Peter Johnson joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.